Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk about Hands on a Hard Body, the last 5 years at Second Stage, and what's happening at Forbidden Broadway. There's a lot more than that, so please stay tuned.
I'm breaking my mother's heart. The longer I stand looking at you, the more I hear it splinter and crack from 90 miles away. I'm breaking my mother's heart. The JCC of Spring Valley is shaking and crumbling to the ground. And my grandfather's rolling, rolling in his grave. If you had a tattoo, that wouldn't matter. If you had a shaved head, that'd be cool. If you came from Spain or Japan or the back of the van, just as long as you're not from Hebrew school. I say, now I'm getting somewhere. I'm finally breaking through. I say, hey, hey, Shiksa goddess, I've been waiting for someone like you.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, March 31st, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being the Broadway MVPs 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com and many other places around the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Michael, so tell us, we had some news about the Sondheim Review we should let our listeners know about.
Yes, they are going to be taking a brief hiatus. The next issue, it says, they anticipate that it will be published and mailed in September 2013. So the summer issue just came out, summer 2013. So I guess they're only missing one. I mean, I think a lot of people really look forward to it. It's a wonderful publication to which I'm happy to contribute occasionally. I have an interview in the issue that just came out with Melissa Errico. And in fact, Passion is on the cover. There's a fantastic photo of Ryan Silverman and Melissa. I think, yeah, it's Melissa. It's kind of dark. It's kind of dark, but it's got to be her because of the hair. So just that's what's happening with the Sondheim Review.
Great. And if you go to the show page at BroadwayRadio.com, there's a link to the Sondheim Review, and you should all subscribe to it because it's the best $20 you'll spend every year to get the four issues, which is great reading. So
yeah,
please.
It's also interesting. Yeah. So many people said, how could this possibly survive? I mean, it's so narrow in interest, but it's been around a long time, hasn't it?
Yes, it's really a great thing. And it has very, very few, I mean, practically no ads. So you're getting each issue is just nothing but content. It's really fantastic.
Well, that's great. All right. So both of you had the opportunity to see Hands on a Hard Body. Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
I kind of liked it. I thought it was pretty good. What I liked very much were Amanda Green's lyrics. She really got into the heads of these people who are living in Texas, Longview, Texas, and are very desperate and need any economic help they can get, to the point of which when a Nissan dealership says, we're going to have a contest, and anybody who puts his hand on our Nissan and keeps it there longer than anybody else will be able to win that truck and take it home. Well, 10 people show up. I don't know if more did in reality, because this really happened, and it was a 1997 film documentary, but they're attending this musical, and and they very much want to win. So it's been compared to Chorus Line, and I understand why, but in a way, it should be more severe than Chorus Line, because when you think of it, 8 people can win in Chorus Line, only 1 person can win here. Mm. More to the point, everybody could be nicer to each other on the Chorus Line because, well, I'm going to win and I can be gracious to the other 3 men or 3 women who are going to win with me. But here, it's survival of the fittest. And I think there should be a little more snarkiness and a little more well, anger from the people, and we don't get very much of that. Also, there's a moment when there's a musical number and everybody keeps time by drumming hands on the car. Well, if you're drumming hands on the car, you're taking them off the car. So I would have rather seen them move their feet while they kept their hands on the car. It has an intermission. It shouldn't. Chorus Line didn't. There's no sense of suspense. I wish there were. What it really needed at the top of the show was a Nazi, a Javert, who at the top of the show, as soon as somebody moved a finger for a tenth of a second off that truck, saying, "You're out." "What do you mean? You're out. That's it." And the next person who makes a casual gesture, you know, we're used to gesturing with both our hands. Somebody should make a casual gesture at the top of the show. Now, truth to tell, that happens deep in the show. Somebody does inadvertently gesture and is therefore out. But it should happen very early so that we really get the sense of seriousness. And that doesn't happen at all. I don't get any suspense here, and I wish I had, because this really had tremendous potential. The music, yeah, country affable. A lot of it sounds the same to me, but nice enough. But what you really needed was that suspense, was that terror, was that fear that you're going to be eliminated at any moment. You know, if you sneeze, you're going to take your hand off inadvertently, that type of thing. It should have been more thought out than it really is. So I wish it well, because there are so many assets, but I'll understand if it doesn't go, because there are so many liabilities.
Michael, what did you think?
Well, I think what Peter said is very smart. I was thinking at the end, and I'm obviously not going to say who wins, but it didn't feel suspenseful. There wasn't any kind of shock, really. And I'm not sure exactly how they would have addressed that specific thing. I mean, there's that wonderful twist that they do in Chorus Line that you know, that makes the entire audience gasp. I don't know. I don't see how there could have been an equivalent in this case. No. But I mean, because obviously only one person can win. You know, they would have had to create some kind of situation where the last two people, somehow you would have thought it would have been the other one. And I don't know how they would have done that. But at any rate, they didn't. So that was, I think, a flaw. Peter's point about having a Nazi is a good one. I thought there were some plot points that didn't necessarily pan out for me. There's supposed to be this thing created where the manager of the dealership is supposed to have a fix-in with this like really hot babe who's one of the contestants. And I don't know, that just didn't interest me really for some reason, the way they set it up. There was also supposed to be some kind of a pact between Hunter Foster and Hunter Foster's character and Keith Carradine's character that I didn't really understand. Maybe Peter could explain it.
No, I agree. it was each of us will support the other if things get tough.
Right, and I guess I didn't understand what that meant.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Okay, all right. So
I'm
it's
with
not
you.
All of that said, I really liked it. I apparently liked it more than anyone I know. even Peter. I recognize its flaws, but I really loved it. I loved the score. I'm so glad to hear what you said about Amanda Green, Peter, because her lyrics have come in for a lot of criticism.
I can't see why. First off, they rhyme wonderfully, an occasional false accent, but they rhyme. Now, I'm thinking of Bob Merrill when he wrote Pretty Bell. And there, to show the ignorance of the Southerners, he made a lot of false rhymes. Amanda Green lets the grammatical errors take that responsibility.
Interesting,
so,
yeah.
But also, really, interesting ideas for songs. That's what's so good. I'll let you tell about them, Michael.
Well, yeah, I mean, and let me say quickly, I also love the the billing is music by Trey Anastasio and Amanda Green, lyrics by Amanda Green. So who exactly wrote what music, I don't know, but I really like the music as well, even though it's not the kind of music I would normally listen to. But I think it's just great. And, you know, there are types in the show. There's the religious woman and, you know, there's the hot babe that I mentioned before. And there's the older guy who's like, you know, who's trying to, who's real, who really needs it and having trouble with his wife, who we also see in the show. But I don't know. They all seem like human beings to me rather than caricatures.
They were. Let me point out, when you talk about his having trouble with his wife, that suggests something that we've seen a million times. The trouble here is the fact that he was in an accident and she's very worried for him. She doesn't think he has the stamina to do anything like this.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And this is the type of thing where so many times men who get sick have wives who overdote, and as a result, the husbands come to resent it. I'm all right. I'm fine, you know, and they're really not. The wife has a point. She loves him dearly. You know, I mean, it's not that she's just being terrible about it. She loves him dearly. She's worried about him. She has his best interests at heart, but he's in the type of denial that he's not as bad as he is. So, again, this is more interesting than usual.
Yes, it is. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of cliche in it, I would say.
And I'm
very happy to say that. I loved two of my favorite characters were the young couple that kind of meet, you know, during this experience and wind up hooking up, and I won't say how. But you know, they're a terrific, terrific cast. Keith Carradine, Allison Case, Hunter Foster, J. Armstrong Johnson, David Larson, in a really, really well done performance as this ex-Marine who has a really quite a very powerful song. Jacob Ming Trent, Kathleen Elizabeth Monteleone, Mary Gordon Murray, whom many of us know from many a show over the years. Jim Newman, Connie Ray, John Rua, fantastic. Keila Settle, who's the Jesus woman. Dale Soles, Scott Wakefield, and William Humans.
Yeah, Dale Soles, who has a fascinating song too, because she starts accusing the hot babe, as Michael mentioned, of cheating. And by the end of the song, something happens that I don't think anybody in the audience would anticipate would happen. But Dale Soles, by the way, if your memory is really good or you were paying attention to Broadway for a long time, was the lady who introduced one of the great cabaret standards of the 70s, West End Avenue, in The Magic Show. And here she is so many years later. She's only been on Broadway a couple of times, I think, as an understudy since then. So it's nice to have her back where she belongs. But really, if you went to cabaret in the 70s, late 70s, you would hear West End Avenue, Stephen Schwartz's song, quite a bit. And here's the lady who introduced it. So it's we're welcoming her back.
Yes. And I can't leave discussion this without praising the choreography. It's actually billed as musical staging
by
Sergio Trujillo. I mean, don't ask me how. He does manage to keep it interesting. They give themselves an out in the sense that, first of all, the participants are given a 15-minute break every 6 hours, we're told. So there are moments where they can actually take their hands off the car and move around. But aside from that, there are sort of fantasy sequences, I guess you'd say, where we're meant to think that their hands are still on the car, but they get to take them off and kind of address the audience. But still, a tremendous amount of time is spent with their hands on the car. The car turns on stage by means of hydraulics or a turntable or whatever. So that also helps. But really, really inventive solutions to this, what might seem to be a very knotty problem. You know, just people dancing with their butts and their legs and their feet and things and their heads and things like that. Really very, very well done. I would not be surprised if he gets a Tony Award for his choreography.
So Mr. Riedel's column yesterday says that is predicting early gloom for Hands on a Hard Body. He does mention, as you guys did, there's a lot of artistic merit in the production, but they're not selling tickets.
Right.
So the rumor is that they're trying to get Tony Award voters in as soon as possible. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah, I can see where it would be a tough sell, but I'm hoping that this is a case of hyperbole, that it's not in as much trouble as some people would suggest that it is. It takes 7 weeks, that's the conventional wisdom, for word of mouth to build, and I hope it can stay around for that length of time. But frankly, there was a musical called Wish You Were Here in 1952 that opened to reviews much worse than Hands on a Hard Body, believe me. And they went back to work on it. I wish people would do that more. Goward Champion went back to work on Dolly and certainly didn't have to because the show was a smash and was selling out, but he wanted to improve it. I'd love to see them go back and do some work on it still. I think there's no reason to sit tight on what they have because it could be so much better. And then I think they'd have no problem with an audience. So that's what I'm rooting for.
Well, we'll see. Am I misremembering? But I sort of thought that Wicked was in bad shape out of town, and they retooled it a lot in Chicago before it came in. And certainly
they took off a lot of time, and obviously that was time well spent.
Yeah, that's the last. Yeah.
You never take off that much time between you're out of town and you're opening, except they did, and look what happened.
Well, there's also the example of the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Well, yeah. I was thinking about successful ones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And Next Normal, of course. How many shows open in New York and then have an out-of-town tryout, which essentially happened with Next to Normal when it went to Arena Stage.
Yeah.
Do the work. You know, I mean, really, all these things can be improved, so why not?
Alrighty. Next up, we're going to talk about the last 5 years, which is at Second Stage. And Michael and Peter got a chance to see it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off this time?
Without seeming to make a fool of myself, I want to say that this is one of the best things I've ever seen in my entire life. I always loved the show and the score. I have seen at least two very good productions of it. One was in Boston, and one was at the George Street Playhouse in Jersey. But it never affected me as much as this one. This magnificent production of I think, really a masterpiece by Jason Robert Brown. And let me say right away, I was sitting there watching the show, and I had actually forgotten who directed it. And I'm sitting there marveling at how brilliantly directed it was. And then I opened my program after the show, which is 90 minutes without intermission, and it was also directed by Jason Robert Brown. So I cannot say enough about what an amazing job he did with it. The knotty problem with the show is that, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, it charts a relationship between a man and a woman over a period of 5 years. But the gimmick is that the man's story moves chronologically forward in time from the beginning of the relationship to the end, whereas the woman's does the opposite. And we see them in alternating sequences in which only one of them appears, usually singing, often singing to the other person, almost always singing to the other person, but the other person not being present. At least that's how it's done here. For 99% of the time, the original off-Broadway production, many people feel made a miscalculation in that the other person was always present on stage, though often in semi-darkness, and so it was kind of a halfway thing that I think general opinion is that it just did not work at all. In this case, what they do is there's the two people, Jamie and Kathy, have a wonderful moment together right at the beginning, and then they go off and then they do their separate things. But at the end of each song, usually what happens is that person stays on stage for just a very brief amount of time, sometimes a few seconds, sometimes maybe a minute at most, as the other person comes on. So you do get a kind of impression of them relating to each other, even though they're not. Then, of course, there's the fact that the actors, Adam Kantor and Betsy Wolf, the actor-singers, are so superb that you really do feel like they're singing to the other person, even though you can't see the other person. So I think that the whatever problem, quote-unquote, this show possesses in that sense has been solved by the beautiful direction of Jason Robert Brown. And also the set design by Derek McClain, it's just perfect. There are these window frames that come down and move around, and on which various projections appear. Whether it's a scene in Central Park or a scene of driving along in traffic on a highway, and they add a tremendous amount. There is a conceit that's established that often the person on stage is singing off stage in one direction, as if the other person is in that direction. And there were a few moments where I thought that was going to be a problem, but then they don't keep it up. They don't sing the entire song that way. They'll kind of turn and sing to the audience. So that was also brilliantly solved. And I have to say, I was so moved. The staging of the one scene where they appear together on a rowboat in Central Park Lake was perfect. And the way that scene started and ended couldn't have been better staged. I can't think of any way it could have been done better. And the songs themselves are just so alternately heartbreaking and hilariously funny and witty and intelligent. And I think it's a modern day masterpiece, and I'm so thrilled that it got this production. I would say that, you know, I mean, my dream is that it could move to Broadway. You know, it's not a Broadway show in terms of size. You know, we've had very few two character Broadway shows, but if you're going just on quality, it absolutely should be there and should win every award conceivable. Not for this season, obviously, because it's too late to move. But I can't help feeling that it would be great to do that maybe like at the end of next season, so that it can, so that it can open right before the awards and then be lauded by every person in the world and just run forever. I love this show. I love the production. The two people are dream casting. Adam Kantor, whom some of us may know as the last Mark Cohen in Rent, in the long run of Rent, and a few other things that he's done, and Betsy Wolf, who has got to be one of the most versatile singer actresses of her generation. There are a couple of moments where I was a little concerned about her voice, because she does some very, very She gets very emotional, and there were some sounds that she makes that sounded a little worrisome to me. It almost she reminded me of Audra McDonald, not in terms of the type of voice, but the way that Audra gives 1,000%, in her belt register and then also in her soprano register. So I hope that doesn't become an issue. I'm a little concerned about that, but as far as the effectiveness of the performance, I was just blown away. And I think I got a sense that the audience was really, really moved. Not just me. It seemed like really pervasive in that theater at Second Stage. So I was over the moon about it.
All right. Peter, what did you think about it?
I liked it quite a bit. But Michael mentions the George Street production in New Jersey, in New Brunswick. And there was something about that production I think every production should use.
That is
projections saying where we are, what time it is, what date it is, what season it is, anything like that to help the audience, because I think it's too much for an audience to infer, her story is going one way and his story is going the other, because we've never seen anything like that before, and an audience can't be expected to pick that up. And that's my only quibble with this production. I have to say, many of our listeners know that I'm the critic in residence at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, and I go out there, and I've been doing it for almost 20 years. And in that time, there have been very few times when Aubrey Berg, the gentleman who runs the program and does it superbly, has said to me, "Hey, you know, in our incoming freshman class, we have somebody really special. Her name is Betsy Wolf." He hasn't said that about too many other people, but he certainly said it about her, and she certainly has come through. She really is marvelous here. And what's so interesting, I would tell anybody who does this show, any woman who does this show, don't expect to get applause at the beginning, because your songs are tender songs, and they merge very quickly into the guy's frenetic happy songs, because again, he's at a happy point in his life while she's at a miserable point in her life. And I noticed there was no applause for her for about the first three numbers. But then she gets her numbers where there's definite applause buttons, and boy, does she tear down the house. This is a very interesting New York story about a novelist who hits it big time very, very quickly, and an actress who doesn't. There are two phone calls that are of great interest, where he calls an agent who has read his book, and, "You're really 23? Oh, call me Linda." You know, I mean, all that. She is being wonderful to him. Wonderful. And he can't believe it. Meanwhile, Kathy, the wife, struggling actress, is out in Ohio, not even in Cincinnati, 40 miles west or south, assuming she mentions. And she calls her agent, who makes it clear that he's on another call. He doesn't have much time. And she says, "Well, I got some good reviews." And you can tell that he thinks, well, if you got good reviews in Ohio, how does what good is that? And he says he didn't get them. And she says, "Well, I'll send you another set." And he essentially says, "Don't bother." And
she says, "Yes, okay, I'll let you know when I do something in New York."
Right. That's the other thing. You know, I mean, in other words, if you're in the city, I will deign to come and see you. But, you know, if you're in Ohio, I have no interest in you. And if that's the best job you can get, therefore, you can't be very talented. So this is a New York story, really, about ambition, and how one person is succeeding and the other person isn't, and how hard that is when one person isn't succeeding while the other one is. And it's often said the greatest love of all is when you can be happy for your partner when he or she is succeeding and you are not. Well, that may be a flaw of Kathy's, and that's what's so good about this show. We do see that there are some flaws in this character of Kathy, and we do see there are some flaws in the character of Jamie as well. This is somewhat autobiographical, a tale. Jason Robert Brown hit it big very early in his life, winning a Tony for writing the music and lyrics for Parade, while his then wife was not having an easy time of it. So she even was certainly trying to stop the show from even happening for a while. And who can blame her? You're not succeeding, and then you have to have the world know you're not succeeding in a musical that's being done everywhere, because if it's a two-character show, you know, and so I will say this, anybody who wants to do this show, yes, two characters, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of costumes. Almost every time you see Kathy, she's in a different outfit. So you also see her auditioning, and Betsy Wolf is very good there in showing that she's not so good at auditioning, that she has problems because she's been beaten down. It's been very hard for her. She's gotten out her six bars when they say thank you and get rid of her. And I mean, so yes, it's a terrific production. As I say, put up those subtitles, those projections, and I'm as happy as a clam. Give people a separate piece of paper, the playbill, saying, "By the way, her story's going one way, his story's going the other. So don't be confused," because it's so bizarre, you know, to expect people to pick that up.
I do certainly agree with that, and I do think that was an excellent facet of the George Street production. The only thing I would say is I expect that very few people today go into it not knowing that, but you're absolutely right that they shouldn't, you know, I mean, they shouldn't depend on their friends to tell them.
Well, yeah, but another thing too, while I was watching and I had the same thoughts you had. Now, Bette Midler's at the Booth Theater. It's a limited engagement. All right. Let's see the show at the Booth. You know, I mean, it is Broadway worthy, and it would look very nice on the stage of the Booth Theater, which is the second smallest theater on Broadway. So I'd love to see it on 45th Street and all that. But if we're talking about that, then we are talking about John Q. Public coming to see it. And as a result, I think John Q. Public needs to be more informed because he probably doesn't have, you know, tourists, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Sure.
Clear. That's all I'm asking.
Interesting how I think it was very smart of Jason to change the character of Jamie from a musical theater writer to a publisher. I think it gives it just that much distance, you know, and to really help it. And I have to say, what the content about the publishing world certainly seems very authentic and real to me. I guess he researched it.
Yeah, you know, I had that same impression, Michael. I really, I was saying, wow, you know, he really knows his onions when it comes to this. Because, of course, obviously, if he was doing the musical theater world, he would know exactly what to say, having been through those experiences.
Right.
But yes, as somebody who's no stranger to publishing and whose girlfriend is a book agent, I dare say I know something about it. And as a result, all of that rang very true to me.
So let me ask you guys a few things about this production. Since you've seen a number of productions before, were there any differences, any updates that Jason has made to the production?
No. In fact, it's definitely set in a certain era because there's a reference to I saw your book at Borders.
Yeah.
And also Sunny Mehta is mentioned. Who's
right.
Was,
yeah. Right. Yeah. So, no, it's definitely in that in that era. I don't think it would be a bad idea if he got rid of those two lyrics and replaced them so that it could seem right now, but it's not the end of the world.
You know, I saw the original production at Northlight in Chicago.
Oh.
And
that's when
Norbert and Lauren Kennedy did it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and then before it came to off-Broadway, and there was a major structural change to the show between Northlight and Off-Broadway where a song was replaced. And I think the rumor was, if not the fact was, it was his Jason's former wife had was threatened to sue unless they changed the song, and they changed the song. And so I was wondering if they had made, you know, any other updates to the thing, but it doesn't sound like they did.
I don't think so, but I always forget that there is a certain amount of spoken stuff.
Yeah,
it's woven into the musical aspect so well that it doesn't really. So you get the impression of it being a through-sung show, but it's not quite.
No. Yeah, I've seen about six productions of it or so.
I've done five.
But there's some harsh words about Jamie, the male character, in this thing, and those came out of Jason's pen. So,
as Peter said, no, absolutely. I when I reviewed the recording when it came out, I said that they're both. That's what's so fabulous is they're both human beings. They're, you know, they're flawed people. She really tends to see herself as a victim. You know, if I can use that phrase, and he can be very kind of condescending, which, you know, I guess happens if you have a tremendous success like that, especially at a young age. You know, he's not trying to be condescending, but he definitely comes across that way. And that just makes it, you know, all the more heartbreaking and interesting because there's these two people obviously so much in love and they just, you know, you wish you could help them, you know, you wish you could just like kind of sit them down and help them solve their problems because, you know, it's so heartbreaking. There's something, again, I don't want to give away the way they begin and end the show. There's a image that they use that will make you weep. I loved it so much, and I can't say enough about his direction. I mean, when I think of other people who are directing who really should not be, in my opinion, and now here comes this person who, I as far as I know, he never directed before. I don't, is that true?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, you know, and yes, he wrote it, but that doesn't mean you can direct it, especially something that's so difficult, you know, and so problematic because of the structure. You know, we mentioned recently that it's been announced that there's going to be a film of the last 5 years. And it's funny because I immediately said, well, you know, in a way, it'll be easier because I think to indicate the time shifts in a film. And I still think that's true. But on the other hand, I don't know how they're going to deal with all of the, you know, with the interaction question, because film is so literal. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they are going to do, you know, this thing like where people are singing these songs that can last some, you know, some of them 4 or 5 minutes, singing to another person who doesn't say anything. It'll be really interesting. I hope they figure that out. Maybe he should direct the movie.
Maybe he
well,
should.
Daisy Prince. Daisy Prince directed the original off Broadway production, but with Sherry Renee Scott as Kathy
and Norbert.
And Norbert. But blank here. Sherry is producing the film.
Ah. Right.
Sherry is producing the film, and so she has lived with this for a very long time as well, as she knows. And so it will be interesting to see. I think that they could actually, you know, use both of them in the scenes in the movie.
I guess they would have.
You know,
but what I'm
one
saying
thing,
is,
though, just as an exercise, I would like to see this done in the proper sequence somewhere along the line. I think that would be a very interesting thing. Yeah, there's a video of the Norman Conquests, that trilogy that Alan Ayckbourn wrote. And it's the scenes are all scrambled. So you might see Sunday noon followed by Monday evening followed by Sunday morning. And as an exercise, I made notes and I did it sequentially to see how it would fit sequentially. And I found it much more enjoyable that, granted, I watch these things at night when I'm tired and, you know, maybe my concentration isn't at the best level. But I enjoyed it more watching it sequentially. So maybe Jason felt it would be too trite a story if he did it in the conventional sequence. And I understand that point of view. I truly do. That maybe it's more challenging for an audience. But, you know, if we're talking about it's moving to Broadway, and we are, that doesn't mean they are, but we are, it's going to be challenging to an audience unless they get those projections up there. Then they'll be all set. I'd like to see it once straight through.
And it's so easy to, you know, to just add those projections. I don't think it betrays the show.
Oh, I don't either.
No, I think.
But seems to me I've heard of various productions of the last 5 years and or Merrily We Roll Along, where the actors at least once go through it, you know, chronologically. For their purposes. I think that would be really helpful. I would never want to actually see the last 5 years done sequentially, but I do absolutely agree that we need to, you know, help the audience out a little bit.
All right. So the last 5 years is playing at the Second Stage Theater, 305 West 43rd, now through May 12th. And as we mentioned, there's a movie being shot of it with, who's the boy playing it?
Jeremy Jordan.
It's Jeremy. I was thinking Aaron Tveit, but it's not. It's Jeremy Jordan.
But I forget the woman was announced too, and I can't remember.
Yeah. And then there's another New York production that's another off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway that's happening in the next couple of months as well.
Actually, James, I think you're talking about the last 5 years is going to be done at the Signature, but not the one in New York, the one in D.C. Actually, Arlington, isn't it?
This is because I only read the first 50 words of a press release. it's too painful to read further into those press releases, isn't it?
By the way, Anna Kendrick has been announced as playing Kathy in the film version.
Oh, thanks for clearing that up.
Boy, that sounds as if they have Broadway ambitions. Anna Kendrick? Wow. Yeah. She's a famous lady now.
Well, you know, all I can say is that God bless Jason Robert Brown. Because he's, you know, it's like he they say that if you have a television series that goes for 100 episodes, you never need to work again in your lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so the last 5 years could be his television series, you know?
Well, I think one of the reasons it's so popular is that it's tremendously popular among musical theater performers for obvious reasons. There are like, you know, about 8 songs each that are ideal for people to do at auditions. But I like to think that it's also just because the quality is so incredibly superb. I have to say, I think this production is a tremendous hit. I had difficulty getting in to see it myself. It was packed when I went. I think it's one of those deals where it's a limited run because it's at Second Stage, but they haven't actually announced the closing date. I would not be surprised if it's extended as much as they can. And I think that everyone in the world should see this.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's no question in my mind that there will be an extension. We'll see if I'm right, but I feel certain there will be an extension. And it's such. It struck me yesterday, Michael, while watching it. People always talked about how hard a role Funny Girl is, and Gypsy, but those, sure. And those ladies have a lot of acting to do in between songs, but nevertheless, you have far more songs to sing.
It's true.
In this show, you know, than you do in any major Broadway musical. So it really is a very, very demanding set of roles.
So, you know, you sometimes see those posters that say must close. And sometimes you can't extend, and perhaps this is again the case with Forbidden Broadway. So Michael, tell us about what's happening with Forbidden Broadway.
Yeah, they're not doing business?
Oh, no, quite the opposite. I went back the other night, and it was absolutely packed. There was not one extra ticket to be had. And in fact, some people were waiting for cancellations, and they didn't get in. I don't want to be officially on record here because I don't know exactly the situation, but I believe the theater on 47th Street is owned by the city and leased to the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater Company at a very reasonable rate. And they in turn sublease it to Forbidden Broadway. But the deal is that the Puerto Rican theater has to do, I think it's something like they have to do at least one show a year, which is why even when they weren't on hiatus, Forbidden Broadway would always close for a few months and then reopen again. So that is the situation here. But on top of that, I'm hearing that there might be some kind of change with that deal between the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater and the city. So Forbidden Broadway might possibly have to try to find another place to go to. And again, all of this is unofficial, and I don't work for the production or anything, so I don't want to give any more details. But that's the situation. It's absolutely nothing to do with the demand. This seems to be one of the most popular issues editions of the show in quite some time. It got rave reviews. And I was happy to go back to see it again because, as is always the case, there was some new material, even, you know, since it opened, what was it, like 6 months ago or less. Also, one cast change. Jenny Lee Stern has left it and has been replaced by Lindsay Nicole Chambers. And the other three performers are Natalie Charlay Ellis, Scott Richard Foster, and Marcus Stevens. It seems like there's a preponderance of 3 named performers in the show. but anyway, they're all, however many names they have, they're all fantastic. One of the new numbers was aimed at Cinderella. And that was interesting to me because I think this is one of those cases. Gerard Alessandrini has always said that that what he writes doesn't necessarily reflect his feelings on a show. Uh-huh. It's whatever the general buzz is. And I know that when I spoke with him about Cinderella, I don't recall him saying anything negative, really. He was very positive about it, which is diametrically opposed to my incredibly negative reaction to it. But here in the show, he definitely goes after it as being disrespectful to Rodgers and Hammerstein, which I certainly agree with.
but that again is not what he professes to be his opinion. So it's interesting to see how he can write something really satirical, even if he doesn't necessarily have a problem with the show. And there were several other new items as well, really fun. The once sequence is hilarious. I did think that Lindsay Nicole Chambers does a better Patti LuPone than Jenny Lee Stern with, and that's a bonus, because there's still a sketch about Mandy Patinkin's the show that Mandy Patinkin did with mm-hmm. Patty, that two person sort of concert that they did for a limited run. There are several shows, you know, several spoofs of shows that are no longer with us because they were flops. And I guess they felt it was, you know, they were too good to take them out. Ghost is still in it. But some of those have been cut down. The Porgy and Bess sequence has been cut down considerably, it seemed to me. Try to get there before this edition closes, because I don't know when you're going to see it again.
So that's April 28th. It's closing, so you have about a month or so to get out there and see it.
Yeah.
All right. Last week we were going to talk about The Flick at Playwrights Horizons, but we ran out of time. So Peter, why don't you tell us about The Flick? We still have 7 days left to see that.
My, there's been so much controversy over this one, to the point at which Tim Sanford, the artistic director, actually wrote letters to subscribers apologizing because so many people didn't like it. I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. The problems and the petty concerns of three people who work in a dying movie theater in Worcester, Massachusetts, made sense to me. Two of the people who sweep out the theater, and we watch them sweep. And by the way, if you get this part, you're a janitor for a night. There's no question about it that you really have to sweep up a lot of stuff and gunk. Because what you're looking at, the audience is looking at, is seats in a movie theater, about 100 seats in a movie theater. And what I love among the details was that in the first row, you could see that at least two of the seats had gum underneath them. I thought that was really smart. Anyway, two of the guys are movie freaks, and they quiz each other, and they have some good times doing that. But you really do get the impression that one of these guys is going to be working in this menial job for the rest of his life. The other guy, there's some hope for. On the other hand, we also see that to make a living doing this, you have to do a little bit of cheating. And it's not hard for an audience to say the cheating they're doing and the money they're making through this illegal way, they're entitled to. Because when you work on a job like this, good Lord, you have to have some sort of perk. They're also interested in the woman who's a projectionist, and the fact that she became a projectionist is an issue too, because that is considered to be, needless to say, a better job. So the big complaint is that it's 3 hours and there are a lot of pauses, but I thought it was wonderfully directed by Sam Gold, and I really felt that there was such tension in those pauses, so I liked it immeasurably. I thought it was one of the finest plays of the season, but I know I'm in quite the minority about this, that so many people just get worn down by the fact that it's so long. Frankly, for me, when a play is good, it doesn't seem long. And this didn't seem like 3 hours to me. What can I tell you? Again, minority viewpoint, but I would like to see it again. So sign me up for another 3 hours and perhaps another 3 hours after that. But again, a minority viewpoint.
All righty.
So. Well, I don't know if it's necessarily a minority. It's hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, the people who really hate it apparently have been quite vocal. But I have some questions, Peter, because I have not seen it. All right. So apparently the specific thing that people are objecting to is that there are a lot of really long silences as these people do nothing but clean the theater. Is that correct?
Yeah, but again, the direction makes you understand, and it makes it seem very real to life. You know, when you're sweeping and you're doing this menial job, you're desperate to think of something to say to somebody because you want to reach out. Mm-hmm. And you get the impression these people are desperately trying to think of what to say to each other. So that's where the tension is, and I found that very clear.
Oh, I don't I don't doubt that. I'm just
I know. You're just asking.
Yeah,
sure.
No, I just have a few questions. So
Are we supposed to see them in an unbroken?
No.
No. Are we supposed to be seeing them after the final show every day?
Well, sometimes they come in early, but you either see them before or after the show. Mostly after the show, when they have their walkthrough, as it's called. That's a euphemism for cleaning up. And, of course, sometimes they really have to clean up a lot of unfortunate stuff because, needless to say, the average moviegoer doesn't care about what's going to happen after he leaves the theater and feels he has every right to litter or spill or worse.
Right.
So,
but it's not. But you're not supposed to see them between screenings, are
never.
You? Because yeah, right. Because that obviously there's
they wait till the end of the night to clean.
Yeah, right. Okay, that was my question. Well, I'm going to try to get to see it because that sounds so interesting. I mean, I would point out that, for example, Waiting for Godot. Most productions of that have always done a brilliant job of showing. Tedium and waiting without necessarily making a show 3 hours long. So
I'm
don't know.
Seeing that soon, by the way, in Amsterdam.
Oh,
in
okay.
Dutch. So we'll see how that the pacing on that is. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So I guess that's the question: is you know how is that overdone or not? And I suppose that varies greatly from one audience member to another. And I also don't know exactly what the percentage of silence is to spoken dialogue.
No, of course. But the other thing, too, is there's an amazing type of tension that goes on while you're waiting to see how – how many times have we been with friends, let's say, in a car? And we've been talking and talking and talking, and suddenly there's a silence, and you don't know what to say. And you don't want the silence to go on too long, because the implication is if the silence goes on too long, you're not having a good time. You know, it's supposed to be you're enjoying each other's company, and what is this silence going on here? The ideal scenario is, oh, we talked all night, there was never a pause, you know, that type of thing. And these people, who are just getting to know each other, and there is an issue, too, of when you work with somebody for a long time, do you become friends? Is that something that automatically happens? No,
yeah.
It doesn't. And that's made very clear here, too. There's a big difference. And any of us who have had friendships in offices or any place else that we've worked, and then one of us has left the job, finds that we don't seem to see that person very much anymore. Now, why is that? You know, and of course, the reason is we weren't really friends. Of course, there are people who do make friendships on jobs and stay friends for the rest of their lives. And of course, there are people who marry. You know, I mean, that happens too. But for the most part, most people who think they have friends at jobs find out they really don't when one leaves. So this is the type of friendship we're talking about here.
So we have 7 days left to see that. So if you have 3 hours, try to get down there and check it out. And, Mike will report back if you do get the chance to see it this week. But a couple of weeks ago, you did get a chance to see Happy Birthday at the Actors Company, which is playing through May 9th. So why don't you tell us quickly about that?
Well, I really enjoyed it. It's an old Anita Loose play. And I, you know, it was great to see it, to see a play with that many characters in it. First of all, you know, I mean, nowadays plays like that, we're probably only going to see off Broadway. Well, with some exceptions. I mean, Lincoln Center Theater gave us Golden Boy. I guess the institutional theaters can. But I thought it was really interesting because it's not, Anita Loose, I think, was ahead of her time. I mean, I think, and it's not the kind of subject matter you would normally think of seeing. And it had great performances by Jenny Bacon and Todd Gearhart, especially. And the fact that it was set in this kind of bar in Newark was interesting to me. And the fact that the main character played by Jenny Bacon is so interesting and not what you would necessarily expect, and that what you think is going to happen to her is not what winds up happening to her. There were a lot of really interesting revelations in it, you know, and for a play from 1940 with a female character like that, originally played by Helen Hayes, by the way, it's just really, really, really very, very interesting. And I think it
I think it's a privilege to see plays like that done by these companies. And I know Peter really enjoyed it too.
It sure is. And I mean, this is one of the best companies with this type of thing. They find these plays that have slipped through the crack. But this was a big hit. This ran, I think, 563 performances, which in those days was an enormous run, even for a play, which in that era, in 1946, plays tended to run longer than musicals because they were less expensive to run. And, you know, TV hadn't happened yet, you know, so that's why you had to go to the theater and see these things. So under those circumstances, we don't see them anymore. And God bless Scott Evans for finding these plays and putting them up there. He's been doing it for 20 years now, and with various partners. And Cynthia Harris certainly has been very much involved as well. And it's they're a nice group, and they always look to see if they can find plays in which their company can. Wouldn't this be a good part for Mary? And this is a good part for Mary Bacon, no question about it. She's a marvelous actress. She deserves all of our commendation and a terrific career. So bless her, too, for doing so well by this role that really was specifically written for Helen Hayes. So nice, nice, nice.
And forgive me, I don't think I actually said the name of the company. It's the Actors Company Theater, which their acronym is TACT.
Mm-hmm. All righty. So that wraps up our reviews for this week, but we have a little bit of news to talk about. First thing that we probably should talk about, which might take up some time, is, Michael, there's a new book that's going to be written, isn't there?
Yes, apparently Jack Viertel is writing a book about Broadway musicals, and I suppose it's what elements make for successful Broadway musicals. The New York Times article on it was not very encouraging, but the problem is that I guess the answer to what makes a successful Broadway musical is incredibly complex. And when you try to boil it down for sound bites in a four-paragraph interview in the New York Times or wherever, I suppose one might tend to make sweeping generalizations that are really wrong. It's really not advisable to make sweeping generalizations, which is what happened in that article. So, I can only hope that the book itself will will not do that, and will point out that for every rule, there are hundreds of exceptions. So I guess that's what I feel. This was brought home to me because I just got a copy of a fantastic CD called Rodgers and Hammerstein at the Movies. It's actually a studio recording of a performance that was done in London. And it's got vocalists like Sierra Boggess and Julian Ovenden. And it's the John Wilson Orchestra conducting the movie orchestrations of lots of Rodgers and Hammerstein songs. I love those movie orchestrations. I really do. And some of them we're hearing in great sound for the first time, like Carousel Waltz, the movie version, the whole thing, which is not on the soundtrack album. They later restored most of it, but it wasn't really great sound because they didn't have the original elements. The recording itself is great, but there's notes by this British person named David Benedict, and again this has been going on for decades that people try to make out Oklahoma as the be all and end all, like the sui generis musical, you know, before which there was never any integration of music and dance and songs being integrated into the plot. You know, some people tend to pretend that every song in a musical before that was just like a vaudeville number or divertissement, and of course that's not true. I mean, Showboat is the major predecessor that everyone eventually remembers and mentions. But also, I mean, I don't know. It's been pointed out that Pal Joey, those songs are very well integrated into the plot. I don't know a lot of Rodgers and Hart shows, but for example, I know Boys from Syracuse, and even though it's a light musical comedy, I would say the songs are well integrated into the plot. Mm. And I'm sure there are many other situations. No, Nanette is probably the lightest musical comedy you could think of. But the very first song, you know, it's not just some silly, you know, number with chorus girls. It's about, you know, Lucille comes out and sings a bit, "Too Many Rings Around Rosie Will Never Get Rosie a Ring." And it's about marriage, you know, and it's about playing the field as opposed to getting married to someone, which is what the musical is about. So even the lightest, fluffiest musical comedy like that had songs integrated. So, I mean, no one is second to me in my admiration for Rodgers and Hammerstein. And it is true that they moved the musical theater to a much higher plane. And I guess the extent of the integration was much greater. But I just wish people wouldn't be so simplistic when they try to discuss this stuff, because it really leads to really silly statements.
This book, by the way, which we started talking about, is by Jacques Vertel, who runs Encores, who's been associated with Drew Jamson for a long time. And I want to make a completely different point about Jacques Vertel. I remember when I was going to see college productions at Harvard and seeing these unknown actors named Tommy Lee Jones and Susan Channing, who became Stalker Channing, and Stephen Kaplan, who became Stephen Mohannon, who will soon be doing the Magilla of Itzik Manger, a 1960s musical that was on Broadway, John Lithgow, all these people I used to see at Harvard. And I used to see Jack Fertel's name in the program, too, quite a bit. Props. Now, my point is, as the musical Seesaw tells us, it's not where you start, it's where you finish. So any of you people who are working in community theater right now doing props, let Jacques Vertel be your inspiration. That he was backstage, he was working, he obviously picked up a great deal of information, and he learned. Of course, it wasn't the only thing that helped him to become what he is today, but nevertheless, credit where credit is due. So I'm very impressed that somebody who had this minor credit in Harvard University programs should turn out to be so spectacularly successful. If he can do it, you can do it too.
So we'll have to see when the book comes out. We'll have to give it a review and see if we can, if we agree or disagree with these points. But certainly Jack is...
it's going to happen with both. We're going to agree, we're going to disagree, of course. Course.
Well, I don't, as I said, I don't know how you could write the book and not note an exception to every rule, because, you know, there are so many shows and so many different ways to do shows, and it's really hard to argue that there's any one template. So I'm sure he's not going to do that. It's just that, as I said, this article, you know, when you try to boil it down to some kind of a statement about a template, I think it's very difficult to do that.
I'm interested in reading the section on Mamma Mia. So, all righty. So next up, let me get his name correct. Shia LaBeouf. Did I get
his
name?
How is that pronounced?
Well, do we really need to spend any more time? Is he ever going to come back in our lives?
No.
Except for he showed up on the front row of Orphans.
Yeah, that's pretty classy, don't you think?
I think that some PR person smacked him and said, okay, this is what you need to do. Sit in the first row and be the first one standing and clap loudly. And that's what he did.
So interesting to me, because several people have interpreted it as the opposite of class and trying to take focus all the attention on him to come to the very first preview and sit in the front row, in the same way that people have had very different interpretations to this open letter to his fans that Steve Kazee wrote. It's really interesting how everyone has a different opinion on what people do and how they behave and how they address things, you know.
Mention Steve's letter for a minute, because I didn't put it in the rundown, but let's talk about that. Steve was starring in Once and had just wrapped up his run and has been out since beginning or middle of February or so with some vocal problems. And he wrote an open letter to the fans on his website, stevekazee.com. I'll throw it in the notes so that you can see it for yourself. Michael, tell me your take on that letter.
Well, I guess in a nutshell, apparently he had been a very, very popular frequent presence on social media while he was in the show. And then suddenly there was silence. And then after about a week of complete silence from him and also the producers, there was an official statement that he was out of the show on vocal rest and hoped to return as soon as possible. That was the extent of the statement. But then news came of a new casting for the show, including both his role and the leading female role, Kristen Milioti. And then it turned out that he never came back to the show. So his last performance was, I don't know, several weeks ago and unscheduled. And again, to make a long story short, in this open letter that he wrote to people, he said that he thought it was most respectful to the other people in the show and also to the fans to remain silent until after his last official day. But but it seems that many people think that it's the opposite and that he could have been more respectful to the fans by – he could have said something rather than being completely silent. You know, I mean, he could have vetted his statement with the producers and just basically said what they said. I'm on vocal rest and I hope to be back as soon as possible. So so anyway, like I said, it's all a matter of how you look at it and interpretation, I guess.
Well, I agree. What's interesting, though, is the expectations now with social media. That it seems like once you make a commitment to it,
absolutely,
you know, you have to keep going, and that's pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, and thanks for making that point because I think everyone would agree that he's not required to mm-hmm. do all that social media stuff. No star is, but those who choose to, then once you do, to suddenly become silent, you know, I don't think that's very respectful.
It's I thought that the letter by Steve was interesting, and that I felt like it probably if he had some input from, you know, an objective person or a public relations person, he wouldn't have gone silent or would have had a better thing there. But, you know, vocal rest doesn't mean your fingers get tired.
Right.
All right. So I guess that does it for today. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there that we each and every time we have an episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us in another way, you might listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is for your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry, and it'll stream directly to that device. You don't have to sync. You can listen to us whenever you'd like. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, you'll see show notes for some of the things that we've talked about today and links to articles and shows and everything else. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me is also there, so get in touch with us if you'd like. So on behalf of Michael Portantiere and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That Irish girls do talk about potato famine. I begin to cry on cue, sing about the Emerald Isle, and get your Irish eyes to smiling. I could be in love with someone like you. I just left a relationship with a lovely girl named Alyssa Levine. She was really great, it was all my fault. I just got upset 'cause she slept with my brother. So I made a vow not to get caught up in the dating scene or the whole routine with the cousin's friend or the who knows what, like I need that shit. I've got marks to make, I've got steps to climb, it's the perfect time. I've got books to write, I've got things to do. I go out my door and bump into you, and the jig is up and my vow is through. I don't know what I'm doing, but come in and ruin me. I will write my own Ulysses if you're there to show me how. Take me back to Glacamora, bathe me in the River Shannon. If you'll be Mrs. O'Leary, baby, I will be your cow. I'll deliver shamrocks daily. Buy your pa a new shillelagh. I could be in love with someone like you. Could be my inspiration and get me past this block and walk me through the great unknown. You could be my true salvation, unchain me from this rock and keep me from being alone. 'Cause I'm no good at being alone. Take me to another level. Let me play in bigger halls. I will do a river dance as long as you keep answering my calls. Get me out of my apartment. Keep me from my empty walls. Someone hire John McCormick. Start the wearing of the green. Let me win the Irish sweepstakes. Let me take you home, Kathleen. I could be in love with someone. I could be in love with someone. I could be in love with someone.